If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I call those markets with low competition. I call those high barrier to exit markets. And so I would much rather be in a market where there's a ton of competition to buy, because I know that when I go to sell, there's going to be a ton of competition for people to buy it from me.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Brian Burke is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital, a vertically integrated real estate private equity investment firm which he founded in 2001. He currently manages active syndications in single-family, multifamily, and opportunistic real estate assets across the United States. Brian is the author of The Hands-Off Investor, an insider's guide to investing in passive real estate syndications, and a frequent public speaker at real estate conferences and events nationwide. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, if you can briefly just tell us, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
I started very modestly. My first real estate investment was a single family house that I had purchased to rent out. I fixed it up, rented it out, sold it a couple years later and made nothing. My second real estate investment was a house flip that I bought, fixed up, and resold by cash advancing my credit cards to buy the house and fix it up. And I sold it and made $1,500. And I thought I was a huge winner. Since that time, though, I've managed to do about 700 more single family homes, both rentals and flips. And obviously the business got a lot better than its very humble beginnings. But over the last 20 years, our focus has been increasingly turned towards multifamily, where we buy apartment complexes all across the country. And we improve those and hold them in our portfolio. So we've got about 3,000 units that we got right now. And constantly growing, except for right now we're shrinking. We're selling more than we're buying, which is a crazy thing for me to say.
Right. Yeah, that is an interesting time to become a net seller. What's motivating that, other than maybe huge paydays? Like, is there anything else in the market that you're seeing that you're going, okay, now's a good time versus maybe a year from now to sell?
I think it's really just happenstance. You know, we've got a couple of properties we put on the market that were just time. You know, they did what we expected them to do. And, you know, their life cycle has come to that point where it's time to harvest those gains and provide our investors an incredible return. And at the same time, we've also noticed that the market has become extremely heated in the markets that we're in. And we've been getting a lot of unsolicited offers on properties that we own. And sometimes you just get offers you can't refuse and you let them go. And so really it's turned out that we've become net sellers, not by choice, but just by circumstance. And, you know, as anybody in this business can tell you, it's difficult to acquire right now. So in as much as we want to be net buyers, it's just harder to find deals right now than it is to find buyers.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, what do you see? I like the idea that, yes, you're making big returns to investors. If the investors weren't there and you didn't have that added, I'm going to call it pressure, it's probably the wrong word, but that added motivation to make great returns to your investors, would you otherwise hold on to them?
No, not really. You know, our business model is to acquire, improve, add value, and sell, harvest the gain, and then do it again. So even if we didn't have investors and it was my own cash, I would still want to harvest that gain and then reinvest it and multiply my investments. You know, you grow by compounding, and you don't get a lot of compounding when you just, you know, do the buy and hold forever approach. You really need to harvest those gains and improve your return on equity. You know, as properties appreciate, the return on equity goes down. And so, you know, the returns get worse if you hold and they get better if you sell. So we sell.
Right. And you make a good point there, which if you harvest that equity, you can then parlay that into, you know, many more assets maybe than you could have if you just let that equity sit idle inside of that asset. So
Or larger assets or more assets. And, you know, whatever the case may be, you're at least putting the money back to work rather than giving money a parking spot. We're not in the parking business. We're in the value add business.
Right. No, I absolutely like that. That's fascinating. So you got people bringing offers to you that you just say, hey, you know, I can't refuse this. And then you close. Do you guys incorporate, do you bring brokers in on that deal to help facilitate those transactions? Or do you just do it buyer to seller?
Well, we would do it either way. It just depends on how these buyers come to us. It just so happens that all of these buyers have come to us through brokers. And they've engaged brokers to aggressively pursue buying opportunities for them. You know, in one case in particular, the buyer was in a 1031 exchange and was desperate, needed something. And we had a property that fit the mold and they gave us an offer we couldn't refuse. So we moved forward.
Right. Yeah. Why not? That makes all the sense in the world. That's super cool. Talk to us about, I guess, what it's been like going from 700 single family homes, which you guys aren't currently buying single family. Or are you still pulling in that into the portfolio?
Well, we do a little bit of single family, but now we're only doing fix and flip. And that's a pretty limited business. We're not doing a lot of that activity. We have a team that's been doing it for a couple decades. And right. As long as they can keep doing that relatively autonomously, we'll let that keep going. But it's not really our main focus. You know, when the market was really bad in 08, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, we were buying 100 houses a year. And we bought about 120 of them, stuck them in a portfolio, held them for rent for 5 years, resold those for about, I don't know, triple what we paid for them. So that was a really good trade. But now we don't focus so much on buying to rent. We have one single family buy to rent house left. It's the last one in our fund. And that one will be gone the next 60 to 90 days.
I gotcha. That's interesting. What was it like growing a team that you could then employ to just go out and, like you said, run autonomously to where you're not involved in the day-to-day? What was that process like?
It was an interesting growth process because we literally went from doing about 10 houses a year to doing 100 houses a year almost overnight. So wow. We instantly had to grow our team. We had about 25 employees. We had our own construction division. We had several people on the acquisitions and bidding side. We were buying houses at foreclosure sales at the courthouse steps. So, you know, we had to have bidding teams and all sorts of stuff. So it became quite an operation. And then, of course, you know, we knew that eventually the foreclosure opportunity was going to go away. It was a short-term thing and we just got everything out of it that we could. And we had to shrink it down, but we kept our core team and left them here and they keep doing what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting point you made. I don't know what year you guys exited the, you know, buying at the courthouse steps and things like that, but we went through a similar phase where it was lots of buying opportunity. And then just as the competition increased, as the margins got squeezed and in the end, you know, thankfully the foreclosures count went way down. Just became way too much work for way too little reward, the courthouse steps. So that's really fascinating. How did you extract yourself in that process of growing from 10 to 100 homes a year? I mean, that's a lot of flipping. That's a lot of moving pieces because no house is the same. So how did you get yourself out of that decision-making process and turn it over?
It came from hiring project managers that could do the decorating decisions and manage the contractors and that sort of stuff. And, you know, we had to stay somewhat involved in all of that, but we had really good project managers. That was really the key to it. Without that, we couldn't have done it. But it was a time in my life where I felt like I was constantly running 100 miles an hour with my hair on fire. And I got to say, I'm really glad I don't do that anymore. You know, now we're doing, you know, on a dollar volume basis, we're doing way more, but on a transactional basis, we're doing way less. So if we can make triple the money doing 10% of the transaction volume, then it makes a lot more sense. And I'm glad to be where we are today. I'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, and your return on time as you've scaled up, I'm sure has been, you know, far more valuable.
Indeed.
Wow. That's awesome. Talk to us about some of the things that you look for in the investments you guys take down the day. Like I know you're an ad seller currently, but what makes a good buy for you right now?
Right now we're looking for apartment complexes that are 100 units and larger, built after 1980, good school districts, good incomes, low crime, good incomes that support the future rents that we're aiming to achieve after a light to medium renovation in markets where people are moving to. That's our main criteria. So, you know, we're looking for growth markets and where we can really go in, make some improvements and really make a difference.
Right. I think that's a key point is growth markets. I mean, one of the things that kind of scares me, and obviously because, you know, multifamily is a hot topic right now, but you see a lot of opportunities that are being presented in markets that really just kind of make me nervous. So I think going, you know, hand in hand with what you're saying, looking specifically for growth markets, of course, that ups your competition though as well, right?
Yeah, it does. But people oftentimes complain about having competition when they're buying, but then, you know, so they go and they buy something in markets where there's no competition. And then when they go to sell, they wonder like, how come we're not getting any offers? I call those markets with low competition. I call those high barrier to exit markets. And so I would much rather be in a market where there's a ton of competition to buy, because I know that when I go to sell, there's going to be a ton of competition for people to buy it from me. And, you know, we just marketed an asset a couple months ago and we had 17 offers. That's what I want. I want a lot of buyers to choose from. I want the pricing to get run up. I don't want to be the one guy that's out there with this property that sits on the market month after month, hoping that a buyer is going to come along and buy it. That's not the market I want to be in.
Right. No, absolutely. 17 offers. That must be fun to see all 17 of those come across your desk.
It is kind of an interesting process to weed through it all. Yeah.
What is that process? How do you select the final buyer? What are some of the criteria? I mean, it can't come down to just dollars.
It doesn't. It comes down to reputation, and it comes down to our trust that they're going to perform on that offer. Yeah. So, I mean, certainly price is a driving factor. So what we'll do is we'll narrow that 17 down to say 3, 4, 5, or 6 based mostly on price and terms. And then we let those 3, 4, 5, or 6 have an opportunity to alter their offer if they choose to do so, to give us the best offer they can. And once they've indicated that they've given us the best offer that they can, we then pick the top groups, and it might be 1, 2, 3, or 4. And we'll have a phone call with each of them and we'll interview them. And it turns into a beauty contest where basically we're looking to see who do we think is going to be most likely to follow through on this offer and get all the way to the finish line. And, you know, all else being equal, assuming that we have two groups that we think are equally likely to perform, then highest bidder wins.
Right, right. That's fascinating. Do you sometimes have multiple brokers bringing offers from, or is it always one broker that's funneling all of these offers to you?
Generally, what will happen is our listing broker will receive all the offers. Every once in a while, you'll have a buyer that's represented by their own broker. It's not very common. We don't see it very often, but every once in a while, we'll see that.
Gotcha. Now that's interesting how you vet, you know, each of these. I mean, because you, like you said, it's a beauty contest. Like, which of you is going to, that's must be a fascinating and fun side of the table to be on versus one of the 16 people that made their initial offer. Like, that's a much less fun, I think, side of the table to be on. You're going, well, did I make my best offer? I'm not quite sure. You know, what do I need to do now to get there?
Honestly, I hate it. I really do. It's like, I'm so used to being on the other side of the table as a buyer. And it's like, I feel for these guys, you know, because it's like, I've been on the other side of it and you hate to be the one that's. But I'll tell you what it is, though. It's a very educational process to go through, because it teaches you, you know, being a seller teaches you a lot about how to be a better buyer, because you get to watch what other buyers are doing and, you know, the terms they're offering and how they act and how they portray themselves as a sure thing. And that's really what it comes down to. I mean, a lot of people say like, oh, I've been making offers on all these multifamilies and I can't get any deals. Well, you know, you're probably not getting deals for one of two reasons. Either you're not offering enough, or the sellers don't trust that you're the best choice. And so what does it take to be the best choice? And that's the loaded question. And really, that's what you learn the most about, is when you're a seller, you really learn what it takes to be a buyer.
Yeah, I bet that does. Yeah, because what does it take to be the best choice? And so, you know, you as the seller are weighing not just, you know, the data that's in front of you, but also, you know, stuff that you can't necessarily tie numbers to and say, okay, is this person going to perform? What do I think? Yes or no? So that is fascinating, that being the seller has taught you how to be a better buyer. One question on that front. When people are coming to you to buy these assets, what do you think their plan is to increase value yet over what you guys have already done?
Well, they always have a plan, right? And doesn't sound much different from the plan that I would propose if I were coming in as a buyer. Everybody sees that there's potential somewhere. You know, we try to leave a little bit of meat on the bone anyway. It's like, we don't want to fix a property up all the way 1,000%. You know, we want to leave something there for the next guy. Because what you find is you actually end up, you can get less money for your property by doing that, because then your buyers don't see any added opportunity for them. So they tend to back away. And so you don't get that return on your invested dollar the same way as you do if you leave a little something for the next guy. and give them a reason to really go after your property with their best offer. But you'll always see they have a plan about how they're going to take units to the next level. You know, there's always one thing they can add. Maybe it's backsplashes or just some kind of a little upgrade that they can do to gain additional few dollars on their leasing turns. And you know, we've had it run the gamut where, you know, we've gone in and renovated units and then seen buyers come in behind us and renovate them again. It seems to work. You know, you look at the property, a couple of years later and you see they're getting more rent than you were getting when you had it. So it works in a market where people are moving too, and there's a push for rentals and there's a lot of demand from residents to rent properties. It doesn't work so well when, you know, units are sitting vacant waiting for a tenant to come along and fill out an application.
Right. And that goes back to the buying and growth markets strategy of yours. That's really fascinating. Let's talk about some things, some lessons maybe that you've learned the hard way. What are some of the challenges, maybe some current challenges, some past challenges you guys have had in scaling your business, and maybe just some practical everyday things that you go, oh my gosh, these are things that can go wrong.
Well, I think every lesson is learned the hard way. You know, people like to say like, oh, I'm going to read all these books and I'm not going to make all these mistakes and repeat all these things. You know, I'm going to do it right. And then you get in there and you screw it up just as bad as everybody in the book that you read. So Every lesson comes the hard way. And, you know, we've learned every lesson, I think, came from some level of experience. And after having done this for so long, I like to say oftentimes I'll say like, I think I've seen it all. But tomorrow will teach me that I have not. And every day is a lesson. Every day I get up is a lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we were talking offline about some things maybe you can't prepare for, but you guys have had just a spat of just some crazy fires happen across, I think, several of your properties here recently. Is that right?
Yeah, we've had a crazy run of fires. I keep saying like, my gosh, it's like, I'm glad I'm not our insurance company, because we had at one property. In fact, I just got a fire report this morning that I got over the weekend at one of our properties. We had a fire. And this morning I got good news. The fire was contained to the kitchen. And while it basically destroyed the kitchen, it didn't destroy the whole building. And I've been getting a lot of news lately talking about buildings being destroyed. So hearing about a destroyed kitchen is actually that's a good news day. And I also found out that the tenant caused it, and the tenant has renter's insurance. So that renter's insurance will probably cover the damage. So that was really good news. You know, in multifamily properties, you tend to have fairly sizable deductibles. And if you have a room and contents fire, it's going to cost you $10,000 or $20,000 to fix it. And that's going to be under most insurance deductibles. So it comes right out of the property's pocket, so to speak. So it's nice when you have residents that have renter's insurance and that covers it. And, you know, of course, that's a lesson from a long time ago, right? Make sure that you require your residents to have renter's insurance, because sooner or later, something like this will happen and it'll either come out of your pocket or the property's pocket, which is really the same pocket, or it can come out of the resident's insurance pocket. You'd much rather have it that way.
Right. And do you guys bill or build in renter's insurance into their monthly billing now?
We don't. You know, some properties do that. We don't do that. What we just require them to have renter's insurance and supply proof of it. We do offer them paths to get it through our property management software. They actually have a insurance division and we can connect the dots for them, but they still have to do it on their own and supply us that proof.
Right. Yeah, that would be, I've heard of that also where, but hey, whatever it is, $12 a month. I mean, renter's insurance isn't much, I don't think.
It's not that expensive. And some owners will do that. And some states would require you to have an insurance license to do that. And so, you know, we're a national company. And so rather than having to navigate all the various state laws, it's just easier for us on a company-wide policy to just require them to supply us with proof.
Right. Oh my goodness. Yeah, absolutely. If you were to rewind the tape a little bit and maybe have a chance to do some things differently, what things maybe would you do differently that might have expedited your progress even faster?
Wow, that's a good question. I think if we could have raised more capital faster, we could have grown our portfolio earlier. And boy, what a run up. You know, hindsight's 2020. There were a lot of times where we were overly cautious. And I think that has served us well in terms of, you know, we've been around and I've been doing this for 30 years and we've never lost our investors' money, never lost a nickel of principal in 30 years, knock on wood. But I also tend to be a little too conservative sometimes, and we've passed on a lot of really good opportunities that in hindsight would have been great for us. And so maybe I wish that we were a little more aggressive sooner, but you know, again, it's easy to look back and say that now. And it's a lot harder to say that when, you know, you're going like, you know, 55,000 a unit. Are you crazy? I just bought a place for 40,000. You know, there's no way I'm paying that number. And now it's selling for like 125. So what are you going to do?
Nothing, man. Nothing at all. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, like you said, but I mean, you've been successful up to this point, and you've met what Warren Buffett, what's his rule number one, never lose money. So, you know, that's when you're still batting 1,000. I mean, you can't complain about that. So that's absolutely awesome. Brian, I've really enjoyed this. It's been tons of fun. Let's jump here into the final four questions. The first one is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Well, I would say it's a lot easier to lose $1 million than to make $1 million. So, and it's the same thing. So don't lose your money first and foremost. Make money, but don't lose it. And don't get too overconfident because it can come back to bite you. Just be very careful.
Right. I love that. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
For me, it's to get enough work-life balance where I can get away and clear my head enough to where I don't overwhelm myself. So I like to spend a lot of time on the beach in Maui and work from there even. And it gives me a relaxed and more energetic approach to everything that I do, even when I'm there, but more importantly, when I get back.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Well, I like to think that, you know, we're improving the housing quality for our residents. That's, I mean, the most direct impact that we can have. And hopefully through observation of things I've done and things that I've written and podcasts I've been on, I can help make the world a better place by giving other people tips and tricks and the confidence to become a part of that solution as well. And also whether it means that they're buying assets as well and improving them, or investing in companies that are, and they're reaping the financial rewards from people who are improving the housing quality for others. I enjoy making that contribution.
Right, right. No, absolutely. Brian, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Either through our website, which is praxcap.com. It's praxcap.com. You can follow me on Instagram at Investor Brian Burke. You can find me at biggerpockets.com answering questions in the question and answer forums. Great place. Or you can check out the book, The Hands-Off Investor, at biggerpockets.com/syndication book.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much for your time today. Do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here. It's been my pleasure.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.